Thank you, Christine. Thank you, Robert. And thank you to Mary Stromberger for allowing the symposium to develop. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I am a little bit nervous. I was cold, but now that I'm really nervous, then I'm warming up, so it's okay. Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to speak to you. I'm not sure that I tackled the talk the way I was supposed to, but I'll give you some tidbits of my experiences and what I've perused from the literature. So in contemporary agriculture, we have crop fields, typically, we all see them, and we have animal operations, and clearly there is a line drawn between them these days. It hasn't been always like that in North America, and it's not like that in all parts of the world, but in North America, that's pretty much the system we have. When I go to conferences on integrated livestock, crop livestock systems, I ask, well, where are you doing some of this stuff? It's like, well, we have to kind of find some places where they're doing. Now there are farmers that have components of it, and that's kind of where I'm going to go to is looking at how we can actually integrate pieces of the system, and the system can be diverse, it can be simple, but how we actually get more from the integration rather than just from the components themselves. So there are some reasons why there's the concern for the divided system. And certainly some of it is because of economic vulnerability with specialized production systems. It doesn't always occur with that. When prices of commodities are high, everything looks good and it's okay. But that can soon shift when prices change. There's a high cost of fuel and nutrients. Now this is a really good time for me to talk about this as gasoline prices go down. But as we've seen, when gasoline prices went up, it stabilized somewhat at a higher level. And I can almost imagine that the price of gasoline will not continue to go down, but it will continue to go up in the future. And there's a risk with all of that, because we're taking from our future, right? I mean, we have it's good to use fossil fuels because we need energy to drive many of our industrial systems, and everyone and all countries deserve that. But if we can use it efficiently and effectively, I think we'll be better off. So pests become greater in monocultures and simple rotations. This occurs in many types of cropping systems, but it doesn't occur in all of them. And so understanding that is important as well. There's yield stagnation in monoculture systems. I talked to some of the crop scientists, and they're really puzzled by why we can't get over this greater yield that is needed to feed the future. This is a good question. So environmentally, the biologically based nutrient cycling could improve both the field and regional levels if we have targeted systems. And it's important in both crop and animal systems, because we have nutrient recycling from animals to cropland, but the nutrients also go from the crops to the animals if we choose to have that kind of grain-fed system. And there's a need for conservation of soil, water, carbon, and nitrogen. And I read over that quickly, but I shouldn't. This is something that's extremely important. Conservation of soil is extremely important. Conservation of water is extremely important. Water is actually talked about even in the general public these days. It's amazing what we need to do for water efficiency. And carbon and nitrogen, those are simple little words, but they mean so much in our world. If we thought about it, all of our activities, all of our biology, our organic existence is carbon and nitrogen. And I always focused on carbon in the past, but I realized that nitrogen is really, really key. Now, carbon is king in my world, but nitrogen is so closely tied to it and so intimately. And when we think about it, our world is nitrogen saturated right now because of reactive nitrogen. We have so much pollution to clean up. So integrated crop livestock systems, there are a variety of approaches. Animal manure application to cropland. So with the poultry litter houses in the southeastern U.S., we can apply that poultry litter. It's a great fertilizer. We're recycling nutrients. This is very good. There's also the possibility of just grazing cover crops. There's a fear of grazing cover crops by producers. There's a fear of grazing cover crops by scientists and by everyone. But we've shown that actually you can graze cover crops in not only in the United States, but in Brazil and other places where it's like everything. If you go too far, you're going to have damage. But if you don't go so far, then you won't have damage. There's an opportunity for sod-based rotation. Certainly, grass was a part of North America, and we need to get grass back into North America. Now, that doesn't mean that that it should be an annual grass like corn or wheat, but we need more perennial grasses, I think, in our systems. There's the possibility of using grain crops for a dual purpose, and that creates the flexibility. So our farmers tend to be specialized for a reason. I mean, they follow the model of the economic model, and so they've gotten rid of fences, they've gotten rid of barns, or all the handling equipment and everything. So crop producers don't like to have animals because they want to go to Long Beach or to Tampa. You know, I'm maybe joking too much. The thing is that our system is that way because of choice. It doesn't have to be like that. Okay, so the grazing of crop residues, this is something that can occur throughout the North America, whether it's in the southern part or the northern part. Residues can be grazed. Agroforestry and silvopastures were mentioned, deep rooting. This is, I think, something that is part of the future. It's perennial, and it's something that I really hope that we can make progress on this, because getting a system that's designed well enough that we can use shade and nutrient extraction to our benefit, this will be really good. You know, it's unfortunate that in Canada they did away with the shelter belt project just recently. I believe they unfunded it. But, you know, there were a lot of shelter belts in the Great Plains as well, and so there was a great service for that. Among farm cooperation, this is where farmers would actually trade nutrients. One farmer producing grain, other producing manure, and operating that way. So that regional recycling potential could be there. And all of these fit under an umbrella of conservation agricultural systems, and that umbrella really is designed for resource efficiency. I think that's where that's where microbial communities really fit in well, is through resource efficiency. That's the way we couch it to a broader audience, that resource efficiency is important, because our resources are becoming limited. If we think about the phosphorus potential that we won't have. So there are many issues of concern, and there can be a national level. The policies are sometimes driving systems the way they are. Regional levels, there may be state regulations or just processing facilities in the region itself. For grass-fed beef, this is a limitation because some people don't know what to do with it, you know, once it's produced. Right, and so watershed level, certainly nutrient planning is important, and how we design landscapes on a larger than field level, but within the watershed itself. The farm level, certainly the choices of crops and animals are there. At the field level, we start to get more specific, and that's where I think we tend to, as scientists, tend to congregate, because we can control things, we can understand things a little better. We can do the other parts upstream as well, but it takes cooperation, and certainly that's where we have to make efforts. But also, we lose control. We can only observe rather than manipulate, and so there's this balance that's needed there. So then we get to the root and rhizosphere, and that's where it's really happening, and that's why you're all in the room too. I know it's an exciting place to be. And there are many aspects of that. I'm not necessarily going to go over those, but there are many aspects where all of us find interest. Then you introduce livestock, and the complexity just increases a lot, because it's spatial and temporal. There are differences there. So that increases, and we can have negative effects, we can have positive effects, and we have to start understanding them. Then we have time. I mean, if we're in our careers, we want to get the results, and of course that's important, but we need these long-term systems to be able to go through and to have them well-designed in the beginning so that we can get good answers throughout time. And then we have our ourselves. You know, we do what we do, and there are various things that enter into that. And so the complexity of integrated crop livestock systems can be very large. So how can research help? Well, we have production and we have waste, and through the analysis of systems is how we're going to make progress on this. And we really should focus on clear boundaries and goals. If we set that up front, it'll be easier for us to know what we're going to achieve. But I think we need both the detailed level as well as the larger scale level. And so we come to the simplicity of soil. I think really, as a soil scientist, soil is simple. It's just that simple. Without soil, we wouldn't be here, right? And that's the message that our society is promoting, and it's a good message. It is very simple. But in soil, we have a lot of complexity, too. And that's I think, as biologists, that's where you fit in, because you understand complexity. It is very complex. We don't know all of the answers, and we don't know all of the processes, and we don't know all of the forms and the functions out there. So, but just to look at some information we have, we surveyed three different fields in the southeastern U.S. This is when I was in Georgia. I still do live in Georgia. My computer has a Vote Georgia sticker on it. Okay, and let's see. So an unmanaged forest where there was it was never really disturbed. It was clear cut more than 100 years ago, but it was nitrogen deficient in there. There were no inputs, but then we had a grazed pasture and a conventionally tilled cropland. We saw that soil microbial biomass carbon was with this intermediate disturbance, I would say. On the far right would be large disturbance in the system and with continual inputs of chemical fertilizers. In the middle, that's where it's intermediate disturbance. It tends to be, it was perennial grass and with organic fertilization. But no disturbance is not necessarily a good thing. And that, it kind of counterintuits with the Conservation Reserve Program. Now, I'm not saying that the Conservation Reserve Program is not a good thing, but there's probably a benefit to mankind to actually get some disturbance into the ecosystem. And if we look at the diversity index of the bacterial population, this was with my colleague, Kamlis Jangid, who looked at it and looked at the diversity, the same thing followed. So the biomass followed, the diversity itself followed the biomass of the soil. So in this case, I'm not sure there's a direct relationship, but there are some associations. If we look at tilled systems, we heard about it several times, that the tilled systems, we have a uniform distribution of organic matter in the soil profile. With perennial systems, perennial pasture, there's this stratified depth distribution of organic carbon, where it tends to be high at the surface and then declines with depth. Now, this is in the southeastern U.S., in the five states listed there, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. And this was on farms that was... We don't know the true management of those fields during the approximately 25 years that they were out there, but it just shows that's what our natural condition would be under perennial grass. Now, with improved management, it may be the change in distribution would occur. But in the southeastern U.S., remember remind myself that it doesn't freeze there, except at the very surface centimeters, okay? And so there's always biological activity with depth. And so that's difficult for us to accumulate carbon with depth. So the type of forage management is important. So this graph here shows that the type of forage management is important. And it shows that when we did not harvest the grass, we had a certain level of carbon accumulation. It was approximately a third of a ton of carbon per hectare per year, which related to 31 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. We applied approximately 200 kilograms nitrogen per hectare per year. So we were saving some carbon that way. When we harvested for hay, which would have been, in this scenario, would have been the most extreme case, we didn't change organic carbon much. But when we had an intermediate level of grazing pressure, where we actually utilized the forage and actually produced beef and had a product that we could consume and sell, then we had the greatest amount of organic carbon. Now, that's partly because of the incorporation of the organic matter with hoof traffic, and that incorporates it into the soil rather than on the unharvested situation where we get photooxidation of the organic material sitting at the surface. So this is an example from Argentina, where organic carbon declines with time, with continuous cropping. If we introduced a perennial phase in that, we can actually boost up the organic carbon. You see that with in the two-year period there, where it oscillates. And then if you increase the length of the pasture in the rotation, it oscillates even more. So this is under conventional tillage. Of course, this is a practice when you don't have chemicals or you don't have the means to control weeds, then that's what you have to do. But this study is an example where there are some oscillations actually in Uruguay, they have a similar situation, and they've converted to no-tillage. So it'll be interesting to see how the oscillations might dampen. Organic matter, this figure just shows that soil organic carbon is related to grain yield. This is from Martin Diaz-Zurita. And it shows clearly that at low organic matter, there's just very little potential for yield. And with higher organic carbon, there will be some plateauing that occurs, perhaps. And so the organic matter is related to the production. to remind you that whenever we sequester carbon, we also sequester nitrogen in the organic fraction. It's just not possible to sequester organic carbon without actually absorbing some of that nitrogen in the soil system. So this can be a really good thing because it actually absorbs, the carbon absorbs as a sponge, but it's absorbing other nutrients. It's just not nitrogen either. It's phosphorus, it's calcium, magnesium, other elements that can be associated with those humic substances. And so it's important when we do look at carbon sequestration to also look at the implications on nitrogen. So this shows that if we actually incorporated a carbon-rich substrate, we'd get high microbial activity in the red line there after that incorporation, and we might get net immobilization of nitrogen that occurs. Now that depends on what the soil is like, what the residues are like of that are incorporated, and how long that might occur might be dependent on temperature and moisture. So it's all complex, but there is that potential for immobilization of nitrogen to occur, and we all know that as biologists, but the key though is that in the end result though, even when we talk about C-to-N ratios of organic amendments, in the long term, there's going to be a net benefit, and there's going to be any addition of carbon is going to lead to some nitrogen mineralization that occurs. We need to capture that nitrogen before it's lost. That's the key. And that is shown here is that we have many losses. We have denitrification, we have volatilization, we have runoff that occurs, we have leaching loss, and we need to really focus on this green area here. That's where the key is this soil organic matter and the cycling of nutrients and carbon right in that system there, so that we can avoid those red areas, the losses that occur. That's where I feel a lot of excitement, and that's we need to focus our natural systems or perennial-based systems on cycling organic matter. And so there are some observations and general hypotheses that can be gained is that biological soil quality can be enhanced using conservation agricultural practices and integrated nutrient management strategies as part of integrated crop livestock systems. So biological soil quality is a key, I think, of our more perennial-based systems based on carbon inputs. And limiting disturbance of soil will preserve soil pores and organic residues for soil faunal and microbial development. We've heard this countless times already today, and it's occurring in all of our research that disturbance can be a negative thing if it's taken too far. Disturbance can be a positive thing if it's only taken to an optimal to the level where it becomes an optimal response. And that's, I didn't share a figure with you, but ecologically there's always this optimal response. Many times there's this optimal response that occurs, and then beyond that we're going to see the degradation. So disturbance is used excessively. I think that's the key. That's why we see conventional systems having soil quality that's low, is because it's used excessively. Adding carbon and nitrogen-rich organic amendments will enhance microbial activity and diversity. I think that's a strong hypothesis that certainly we've seen results that support this, and it's something that we can follow through with. It's actually characterizing that in a better fashion that's important. So in that characterization, my research in the past has looked at these different fractions of organic matter, the total organic carbon, the particulate organic carbon, the microbial soil microbial biomass carbon, and carbon mineralization. Certainly plant residues feed into that, animal residues feed into that as well. Any kind of carbon source is going to feed into that. But it's also an area where fractions are different than pools. Okay, fractions are laboratory defined, and pools are more temporal. They go into our models. But there are some relationships there, and that's where if we could actually identify some of the fractions with accuracy, Bob, you mentioned about methodologies that are standardized. It'd be great. I mean, that shouldn't limit you from exploring always new methodologies. I think that's extremely important. We all always should be exploring new methodologies. But having some standardization would be good, because then it would fit into a model. We'd be able to predict something with a greater certainty then. So I think when I showed the figure of soil as simple and that it's complex, well, this is where I wanted to take it. I think soil is complex. There are many things we don't know about, and certainly I don't know about, but there are some simple things that we can gain from it already. I think there are some indicators that certainly give us some idea. And one of those ideas came to me in my PhD many years ago, is that when we were looking at fumigation incubation as a tool for microbial biomass, We actually saw that there was differentiation in the rate of carbon mineralization that occurred among different soils. These soils were different at the in the beginning of the incubation, and we happened to dry the soil. I know that, you know, at my Dave Zuber was my my colleague and my mentor that told me you don't do that. Well, I did it, okay? You know, and so I did it. But actually it mimics nature. Soil dries out. We don't have soil that's continuously wet. So there are places, maybe in Switzerland, I don't know. the soils do dry out, and so it's a natural phenomenon. So it's not something new. But we actually found that actually it kind of replaced the chloroform desiccation procedure itself. So we could actually use that. But the key though is the difference in the results of the five different soils on the left and on the right. It maintained that relationship. That's what I wanted to point out. And when we looked at the relationships of carbon mineralization with nitrogen mineralization, this happened to be really old data that just generally shows that the statistical difference that occurs at the end of the incubation also occurred early in the incubation. So that's why we started looking at more at this flush of carbon dioxide that occurs early in the incubation as a tool. Because I think we need tools to relate our ideas of soil organic matter to the general public. And so we found that the flush of CO2 during 3 days of re-wetting the following dried soil was highly related to microbial biomass carbon. And there was that's in a general sense. When you think about the flush of CO2 going from 0 to 1,000 parts per million, that's a huge range. I mean, you can't just find that in any neighboring soils. So this was from different depths of soil. This was from different management. We looked at tillage as our primary variable to differentiate. What we also found was that it was highly related to nitrogen mineralization. And because we know from our research that carbon and nitrogen mineralization are related, of course, there's always that complicating factor of immobilization and volatile losses and leaching losses of nitrogen. So that there's not always that stable relationship, but it showed that there was a relationship if we could actually capture it in the right format. And I think this format is by drying the soil and re-wetting it and looking at the initial flush. So it relates to that. So what we're going to try to understand in our next round of research is based on this idealized response. Is if we have nitrogen, we know that if we have limited nitrogen, we're going to have low yield. It's just that simple, right? If we quantify all of the components of nitrogen. And so we have to quantify all the components. We have to know what the inorganic nitrogen pool is, whether it's at the surface or if it's deep in the profile. Now, in semi-arid regions, deep in the profile means that it's a resource that may not go away, and so we can capture it. In more humid regions, it might be lost. And so we have to understand the ecosystem that we're in. But the organic part is what's really still missing. Almost none of our soil testing laboratories in the United States use a nitrogen tool anymore. Well, they're starting to now because of this tool that is being developed. But in the past, we had such difficulty understanding how we could actually characterize the organic pool. It's the there because of all the different fractions there. There's no clear separation. There's a gradient. We can't characterize it well. So we know that sites with low nitrogen availability will have high fertilizer response. And that's clear from the literature in the past 50 to 70 years. That our agronomists have told us that, and they've shown it. And sites with high-end availability and low-end fertilizer response, these occur. I talked to my colleagues in the eastern United States, in Virginia, in North Carolina, in South Carolina. These sites occur every year. There are places, but they don't know how to characterize those sites, why they're occurring. Sometimes it's because of the rotation. Sometimes it's because of the inputs, of the type of the inputs. So our goal is really to enlarge the biologically active nitrogen pool without causing nitrogen leakage. This was mentioned before. We need to avoid this nitrogen leakage that's out there. We can't just simply pour on more fertilizer because our waterways will be polluted and we will pay for it somehow in our health or in our environment. It will come back to us. Okay, so I want to move along and wrap it up. These are observations from the past. We see that continuous corn yield is dependent on nitrogen fertilizer. This is common. When we start to increase a little bit of diversity, we can mute that response. And certainly when we had legumes where we know there's biological nitrogen fixation, we can mute that response completely. We don't get any response. And that can occur under those annual systems, or it can occur under the sod-based systems with alfalfa or with Bermuda grass and clovers in the southeastern region. And tall fescue. So those responses are what we're really, that's where I'm going to go back, okay? So I can't go back to 1970 when Bill Adams published these data, but I can go back to those types of systems and try to understand. So we have both nitrogen savings, where we've typically looked at the reduced nitrogen fertilizer input, but we also have this curious rotation effect, and we've struggled with this for a long, long time. We still don't understand it. Now, maybe more of it is nitrogen than what we think. It's just how we designed the experiments and actually how the nitrogen, the crops respond to nitrogen. So I think there's still something there, and certainly there's something there from the biology and the physics and the chemistry. So all three of them are needed. And I think that this is where we can input, if we can actually use this flush of CO2 as a tool. So this is my contribution to the symposium is using a tool that we can think we can use in the future, is I think we can use this simpler based tool, and it doesn't have to be exactly this. I had a colleague that I talked to that used 4 days. I have another colleague that used 1 day. You know, all of these responses are curved. And if we understand the response, that's all that's important. But if we can use these as a tool, we can characterize rather than, okay, there are colleagues that also have rotation experiments where alfalfa precedes corn. The corn doesn't always respond the same. But if we knew how to characterize the soil, maybe we could understand that better. And that's the idea that I wanted to leave with you. So we are not alone. There are many that have come before us, and they've struggled with this. Certainly, Selman Waksman was a leader in soil respiration. And as when I first started, for all of you young people, I first started in soil biology, and I was really excited. And that's what I saw is I'm not a classically trained soil biologist, but I think that soil respiration is something that you should really look at. Don't give up on it. It's simple, but it's something you should not give up on. And so the Birch defined the drying effect. He came afterwards, and George Stanford was really one of the pioneers and one of the great leaders in this area of defining nitrogen availability. And so we've had to build on all of that. I mean, we're not doing this, you know, just from scratch. All of this comes before. This table here just shows that almost all of our attempts to look at nitrogen availability come from chemical extraction tests. We're trying to characterize biology with chemistry, and it just doesn't always work. It can work in a certain sense, but we need to use biology to characterize biology, right? So that's why the incubation procedure, the flush of CO2, is there. So I'm going to leave you with these final sets of slides. Is that we looked at the flush of CO2, and we looked at whether it was under intensively grazed cover crop system or not. We didn't find actually any difference in the flush of CO2 between the grazed and ungrazed. We did see with depth. We see that the characterization of soil is very important with depth, because this was under a conventional tillage, and our soils just tend to build up organic matter at the surface and very little with depth. With no tillage, the depth gradient was much larger, and that's all we saw. There was no difference between grazed and ungrazed. So when you think about grazing, most people say, well, you're just harvesting that material through the animal. Well, but actually the animal is redepositing most of the stuff back onto the soil. So we're not really losing that much, and these data show that we're not losing that carbon. We're actually keeping it in a form that is similar to what was there. But I think the key is understanding, are there greater opportunities for nitrogen availability? So this just shows the data for the nitrogen mineralization that occurred, and I wanted to show you the actual relationship between the flush of CO2 and net nitrogen mineralization. This is at the end of 1 year of the study. This is at the end of 2 years of the study. The line didn't change. They're scattered, and this was at the end of 3 years of the study. So there was a stable relationship between the flush of CO2 and net nitrogen mineralization. There was plenty of scatter in these values that are at high level. That's where we have to start understanding, because the quality of the organic matter that's there may be really important as well. And that's where we need to fine-tune this relationship. So I'm going to just stop there. Thank you very much.